Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. We're delighted to have you with us today. And we're going to talk today about the progress in the war on cancer. There's been a lot in the press about this, and there was a very big meeting sponsored by the American Association for Cancer Research yesterday at the National Press Club in Washington. So we have with us today Chandra Hall, who was in attendance at the meeting yesterday, and she's going to share some of her impressions with us and help us understand some of what went on at yesterday's meeting. So today we have with us my good buddy Mike. Hi, Mike. This is Mike Lawing. So there's Mike Lawing's voice, and we also have Chandra Hall. Welcome, Chandra.
Hi, Joyce. Thank you.
So, Chandra, tell us a little bit about what you do at home in Arizona.
Thank you, Joyce. I am a cervical cancer survivor going on 14 years now. And when I was originally diagnosed at the age of 28, when my husband and I were trying to start a family, it was pretty devastating, as you might imagine, not to only find out that you cannot have kids, biological kids, but that you also have this potentially life-threatening disease as well. So all in one fell swoop, we were dealt with a pretty hard blow to our whole entire dynamic. So we came through that really, really well. I'm here 14 years later, and we're not only surviving, but we're thriving. And part of that, I decided to turn into kind of giving back and reaching out to others that were going through something similar. Because when I was first diagnosed with a gynecologic cancer, Coleman was first coming on to the scene, and breast cancer was everywhere, but you couldn't find anything about reproductive cancers. And I felt ostracized and alone and somewhat ashamed, and because nobody wanted to talk about it. So I just said, you know what, they need somebody, they need a champion. I have a big mouth. Why not put it to good?
So, good for you.
Thank you. So I started volunteering for the National Cervical Cancer Coalition. I've been with them for several years now. And that's really opened a lot of doors for me. And one of those doors was being asked to participate as a patient in the 2012 annual report for the American Association of Cancer Research. So as a part of that project, they invited myself and I believe 13 other survivors up to Capitol Hill yesterday for that press conference to sit, observe three of my patient friends, I'm happy to say, survivor friends. They told their story to the attendees at the press conference, and they were very compelling and moving stories, as you might imagine. And so through that, we had amazing opportunities to meet with congressmen, to meet with senators, and essentially explain to them why research is so critical. Research is our best defense against cancer. And so this was a prime opportunity to go to them, speak to them, implore them not to cut spending as far as research is concerned, because, of course, everybody is facing cutbacks right now. And one of the figures I had heard yesterday during the day was that they are going to cut back cancer research funding by 8%. And if they decide to continue to move forward with defense spending and keep that status quo, then that cutbacks are going to have to come out of every other department, which means that they're going to have to double down, which means cancer research funding will be cut by 15%. And although that doesn't sound like enormous figures, one of the scientists that I had the amazing opportunity to speak with and have a good conversation with about this likened it to cancer research going back a solid decade. So because we're going to lose that momentum of all the research that has been done in the last many years, we're going to lose those opportunities to cultivate those partnerships, those collaborations, and lose the opportunity to continue to encourage and support up-and-coming researchers and scientists. And we simply cannot afford to lose those opportunities.
Let me ask you to clarify for everybody who's listening, when you say we went to the Hill, what does that mean?
Well, that's kind of their local lingo for Washington, D.C. Going to the Hill typically means you're going to speak with different members of Congress, different members of the Senate and maybe lobby for some reason, have business up there. And so as a part of that, I was at the state capitol. I spent some time at the Senate. One of the featured survivor stories in the report is Congressman Carr, and who's a Michigan boy, and I grew up in Michigan, and so we had a fast bonding there, and he gave us a lovely overview of what was going on, kind of as a layperson, because there were some amazing world-class scientists there at this event, because they were all there for the release of this report, but they wanted to keep the faith of cancer in front of everybody and not only remind the scientists what they're doing and why they're doing it as far as the patients go, but also remind Congress and also remind the everybody in politics, essentially, that we could come across that, you know, these are real people. We are affected. It's just cancer research is not tubes and vials and microscopes. It affects everybody. You know, the statistics are staggering. You know, 1 in 2 men, 1 in 3 women. You know, I think everybody can probably recite those in their sleep these days. But it was just an amazing, amazing experience. And the information that I gained access to and the information in this particular report has to be disseminated amongst the public. And so that's what I'm hoping to help with today.
Great. So let me just underscore that, because I don't know if everybody has heard that. But if you haven't heard it, we're saying that now we're at a point where cancer is so prevalent that 1 out of every 2 men is going to experience cancer in their lifetime, and 1 out of every 3 women, or did I get that backwards? I got it backwards. So 1 in 3 men and 1 in 2 women.
My apologies.
No, that's okay. But in any event, it's really high. And so almost everybody is going to experience it either personally or certainly amongst someone that they love. And cancer is something that touches us all. We've worked a lot on cancer. I mean, this war on cancer was launched by President Nixon. This is quite a while ago. It's 40 years, is it?
40 years,
I think this
is
the 40th anniversary of the war on cancer. And what have we achieved? We've actually achieved quite a great deal. Breast and prostate cancer are down more than 25%. They've gone down 25% over what they were 40 years ago. The deaths from breast and prostate cancer, the survivability of those things is much easier these days, both because of drugs and even more so because of early detection techniques and better methods of treatment. But nonetheless, there's a ton more to do. Pancreatic cancer has gone down only a sniff. And kidney cancer is still by no means solved. So there are lots of other cancers that need to be taken care of. Melanoma, we're starting to make a dent in, but there's a lot more research. And also the research on drugs is accumulating. They build on, you know, we learned this. Oh, so if that's true, maybe this other thing is true. So they learn from it. And they're refining the drugs. The drugs are getting better all the time. And, Mike, maybe this is something you can speak to a little bit, that we've got such a momentum. We really need to keep that momentum going.
Absolutely. And, Mike, if I may take this moment, I want to your point, Joyce. With Senator Moran yesterday of Kansas, I told him that I am a cervical cancer survivor, which is now known to be heavily affiliated with HPV viruses. Well, now we have the 2 FDA-approved vaccines for prevention of the deadliest types of the viruses that cause cervical cancer. Well, now it's been approved for, the Gardasil in particular has been approved for use in males. Why? Well, they found a cross-efficacy where it has prevented 100% of genital wart transmission in males. Well, guess what? They start digging a little deeper. They're finding more and more cross-benefit to these particular vaccines and efficacies of these vaccines. Recently, there's been a link to HPV infection and head and neck cancers. Many people think that head and neck cancers are associated due to oral tobacco, smoking tobacco, and that's not necessarily the case. They're finding that actually the majority of head and neck cancers are now caused by HPV infection. So if we stop the research that is currently going on, trying to find those cross efficacies for things and treatments that are already out there that might be applied in different ways, that would be devastating. We don't necessarily have to reinvent the wheel. We're not asking for the funding to start something that hasn't already been started. So we are right on the cusp of these amazing, amazing developments. So cutting that funds and cutting those developments can be devastating to a huge, huge broad, and will be devastating to a broad spectrum of America, and not even just America, but we lead the world in this research. So it's that whole global situation that we're going to impact as a result.
I'm trying to think of an analogy that will help people understand this. If you look at the progress in electronics, 40 years ago, where were we in electronics? Nobody had a home computer. Everybody was using typewriters, electric typewriters, true, but nonetheless, we were all typewriters guys, remember? And there were no computers, none of that stuff. Now we have more compute power in our pockets than it used to take to fly guys to the moon. Mike, can you speak to the progress in drugs? I mean, you've been exposed to drugs for cancer for the last 15 years. And what's the progress that you've seen between 15 years ago and today?
Well, I'm going to emphasize something about this entire press conference before I start on that. The AACR website is aacr.org. The entire press conference is on video, and it's downloadable and viewable from that site. And also the 2012 Cancer Progress Report that they have written up, and it's got Chandra's story in there, a beautiful full-page picture of her and everything. It's about a 98-page report. It covers the entire spectrum of research, development, how we got where we are now, where we need to get. It's got all kinds of material in there that everyone that is listening to this podcast should go to the AACR site and download it, because this is a powerful piece of information. I've spent a couple hours today trying to look at the podcast and the material that's in there. And it lists pretty much all the drugs at the very back of this report that is now available for different types of cancer. In 1971, when we declared war on cancer, and I think the three of us agree, that was the Dark Ages. Everybody thought, well, we'll find one magic bullet, and that will take care of everything. And still today, we're losing about one person every minute to cancer. Like you say, it's one in every two men, one in every three men, women that's going to experience cancer in their lifetimes. And none of them are the same. They're finding several subtypes. And with the medications that we're coming out with now, the targeted therapies and the immunotherapies, they target specific pathways in the cellular structure, in the DNA, in the human genome to either shut off or to start some type of a response in our bodies. And so it's critical that we can find these switches and be able to turn them on and off. But it takes a lot of research and a lot of money to do that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're right at the cusp, as Chandra says, about getting some of this. One of the things that came out of the report that I thought was so crucial, and I think Chandra can go along with this, it's like with the HPV, the screening and the prevention of all this stuff is very highly available if we would just take advantage of some of the things that's out there. Chandra, you got a point?
Agreed, absolutely, Mike. In fact, I believe there is a statistic in this report, and it's on page 28, that two-thirds of cancer deaths are a result of preventable causes. And, to find that, how many cancers do we have that, I hate to keep harping on the whole HPV vaccine thing, but it's very topical right now, and it has such a broad spectrum of applications. That wasn't even heard of a decade ago. In fact, I wasn't even a candidate for it. It didn't come out until after I had already been diagnosed and treated. And so I know that there's a big movement that's starting to wane a little bit now, but there was a big movement at one time where there was a pretty blonde actress and she was advocating that vaccines had given her son autism, and so there was an enormous wave of anti-vaccination across the country of young mothers because they were terrified that this autism was going to strike their young children. And as a result, what has happened? We've got children dying of whooping cough, for the love of Mike. I mean,
that's right.
It's just absolutely unacceptable. And I am not one, don't get me wrong, I'm not one, I do not have children, and I'm not one to tell parents what they need to do with their children. But what I totally feel in my heart of hearts is my role is to educate them about HPV, FDA-approved vaccines, the good, the bad, and the ugly. All of it is good, I'm happy to say, but they can take that information back to their children's doctor so they can make an educated decision as to what is best for their child and not just some knee-jerk reaction because the, you know, hot off the presses of a local magazine or tabloid magazine that, you know, so-and-so said that this was linked to that, and so, okay, now I'm not going to do it. So education,
right.
Absolutely, Michael, to your point, is the key.
And we should hasten to say that all those claims about autism being linked to vaccinations have been disproved. That is not true. But it is a myth that is out there and is being proliferated by, as you say, the exploitative magazines.
It's so sad because wouldn't it be nice if that whole the debunking of that myth had gotten as much press as the misinformation that was initially spread. But
right,
you can't
exactly
find that anywhere. You know, take somebody that's in the know, and unfortunately, people still don't want to believe it. So
that's right. When whooping cough and mumps are making a comeback, this is really awful. And I'm old enough, I remember if you had chickenpox and you had not gotten any bumps yet, but the day before your bumps came out, you went to the grocery store, anybody who passed you in the grocery store could get chickenpox from you. It was that contagious. And if a pregnant woman in the first trimester of her pregnancy got chickenpox, her child was usually multiply handicapped. We're talking blind and deaf and mentally retarded. And I worked in a facility for multiply handicapped children. So we really do not want chickenpox or mumps. They are not trivial diseases of childhood. They are potentially very serious, very deadly, very nasty diseases. We have learned how to wipe them out. We need to keep them wiped out. And similarly, we need to build on the knowledge and the drug development that we've already got in hand. Because every time they go to a next generation of the drug, they refine it a little bit more. It gets more specific. It gets down to the right place and does its job more efficiently. That means you need to take less of it, and that means that you get fewer side effects. So that's the progression that we're in right now. They're learning how to do it better and more efficiently and with fewer side effects.
And one thing else that that we need to be mindful about, as we tend to say, well, we've got some of these cancers almost completely curable by the treatments that we have. These cancers have a way of being ingenious about avoiding and overcoming the treatment options that are out there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we're constantly going to have to evolve on newer and newer generation treatments to continue to wipe out these cancers. And one of the things in the report, I think, Chandra, you mentioned the percentage of the cancer cases and deaths, you know, that was caused by factors. A lot of people tend to say, well, it's unavoidable, it's genetic and all this, but the report identifies that family history only accounts for about 5% of the cancers, UV and radiation about 2%, and pollution about 2%. So we want to put a lot of things on the environment and other things when it's a lot of other factors that's causing these cancers that we can do something about.
Absolutely. And even on page 44, Mike, it says 1,000 more lives could be saved from just from colon cancer alone if 11% more of the population followed screening recommendations. And again, these are preventative measures that we all, not all, majority of us have access to. And I'm happy to say there's a large movement to break down those cancer disparities in those regions and those demographics that don't have a whole lot of access to cancer care and cancer screening. But, you know, that's a whole different show for another day. But it's shocking when you see the statistics and the numbers in this report. And I was shocked to see so many of these just basic facts that really you just don't even want to believe. But when you have them there in front of you, you can't deny it. Increased risk for at least 8 cancers are linked to obesity and inactivity. And so I look up and I see the mirror and I'm like, Jennifer, that's you. You know, you got to do something about
right.
that. So.
Right, and it always does come down to, and what are you going to do about it? As one guy said, eat more broccoli. That's one thing, but, you know, we need to get a little bit more serious about taking our risks seriously and doing something about it. But let me go one step deeper with what can we do. And there's a lot of the report that focuses on the funding for healthcare and the funding for research and why this is important. So tell us what you came away with and why it's important.
Well,
it looks like a humongous amount of money. If it's measured in trillions, most of us can't even think that big. So, you know, if they've already got trillions, why does it matter if they're going to lose 8 or 15%?
Well, according to the scientist that I spoke with yesterday, and I kind of asked that same question because, again, I'm not a clinician. I'm not a researcher. I'm just a girl that got cancer and kind of parlayed that into advocacy. And so I will say that I know a little bit more than the average bear when it comes to cancer and cancer statistics, but I asked him to break that down for me, and he said that, you know, if we don't continue the funding status quo, not even with an increase, but just at the level we're at, that the cutbacks can set us back by an entire decade. And that's shameful. I mean, who wants to go back
right.
10 years? Think of where you were 10 years, again, using the technology analogy. Think of where technology was 10 years ago. I mean,
how many people had a cell phone 10 years ago? Right. I mean, that's just to make it real for you. How many people had a cell phone 10 years ago as opposed to today? So, you know, that's the advances in technology that we're talking about. If we can sustain that motion, then maybe we can cure cancer in the next decade.
Well, the basic message that the American Association for Cancer Research, their call to action was essentially they are wanting they're respectfully urging Congress to work in a constructive and bipartisan fashion to find a more balanced approach to address the federal deficit and prevent sequestration from occurring in January. And they want to designate the National Institute of Health and the National Cancer Institute as top national priorities by providing annual budget increases at the least comparable to the biomedical inflation rate, which I thought was, you know, that wouldn't even be in my consciousness if they hadn't educated us about that. And they
right.
went on to say that, well, it's imperative that Congress take action to stop the threatened sequester and make funding of the NIH and the NCI national priorities. The responsibility is not theirs alone, and the AACR urges the citizens of the U.S. who benefit from the life-saving research to urge their respective legislatures to support cancer research and biomedical science. So I know you and I talked briefly on the sequestering. Maybe you could speak a little bit more to that.
Yeah, you just said the $200 word, which is sequestration, and everybody goes, let's fight sequestration. It's like, excuse me, what does this mean? So the way the game evidently is played on the Hill is that they approve a budget, and they say we're going to give X to the National Institutes of Health, for example. And then at the end of the term, they go, oh, well, we really don't have that much money in the bank. So our choices are that we allocate more money, in other words, go farther into debt, or that we decide who's not going to get quite as much as was in the budget. So what they originally said was, all right, everybody, all departments, will take an 8% cut. But then some departments squawk louder than others, and some of them get exempted from that sequestration. So they sequester the money, the difference between the budget and what they really have to pay out, what they call the allocation. So they take that difference and they sequester it and they say, what are we going to do with this? And when it comes to big ticket items, like, for example, defense, if they take 8% out of defense, that's a huge chunk of money. If they don't take that 8% out of defense, then there's that much more money to go to all the other departments. But if they do, that means all the departments are going to take a deeper cut. And right now what's on the table is to exempt the defense budget. In other words, pay them everything that was in the budget, not just what we have in the bank. So if they do that, then the cuts for all the other departments that have not been exempted is going to be 15% instead of 8%. It's going to take a much bigger bite, which when you turn that into research grants, that's probably another, 25,000 grants?
Yes.
Which is, you know, astronomical. And then, again, these are not grants that our amazing scientists and clinicians and researchers want to reinvent the wheel. Some have amazing ideas and theories that they've seen play out in actuality with their patients, because we don't necessarily have the clinicians that only treat the patients and then have researchers that only do research. We have people, we have teams and groups that work together, and we have physicians that say, you know what, I have had 20 patients with X cancer, I've given them Y drug, I have found maybe an anomaly in the uptake of this drug, and that 50% of these patients are doing really well, 50% of the patients not doing so well. I want to dig deeper. I need to do some research on this. And so that's when this funding comes in, because it doesn't necessarily start at the top. A lot of the times it starts at the bottom and works its way backwards, and there's already been some sort of proven benefit or either to quality of life or to longevity of life, and they want to get to the heart of that, because if they can figure out what's going on there, they can make an enormous impact. You know, Tarceva is one of those drugs that kind of was found out that way, which is an amazing, amazing drug that's saving a lot of lives, and not only saving lives, but giving a great quality of life along the way as well.
Yes. And,
so go ahead.
We've got about 2 minutes left for y'all to sum up, but the report, the progress report, is available at www.aacr.org, and you can get a lot more information. And Chandra, I'll let you and Joyce sum up.
Well, let me just say, too, that we talked before about what can you do. Any of our listeners can actually, from their armchairs, go to the Hill. And what that means is tell your members of Congress how you feel about cuts to the research budget for the nation. And, you know, how important is this war on cancer to you and to the people that you love? And you can tell them that by, you go to rarediseases.org. That's the National Organization for Rare Diseases. They have it's called a CapWiz account. You look for the little Capitol Hill icon and click on that, and it will very easily help you send emails to your members of Congress. Chandra, you want to give a last minute message to our listeners?
I would absolutely support that that role that the average, everyday American can take. These congressmen and these senators want to hear our stories. They want to see our faces. And if we don't voice our opinions and we don't voice what we want to see, they're not going to go in the direction we want them to go. If we don't ask, they're not going to do it.
Right, and that there's no one program that's more important than another, but certainly cancer is something that is very important to all of us, and we don't want to see it axed in order to pay for other things. So thank you so much, Chandra and Mike, for being with us today, and we hope that everybody will make their own voices heard on powerfulpatient.org. You can put your comments on at the end of the show, and certainly go to rarediseases.org and make your voice heard to your members of Congress. So we hope that everybody will do that and be with us next week. Next week we have a woman who's written a book about her experience with von Hippel-Lindau disease. We hope you'll join us then. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.